Well, welcome everyone, and welcome to the next in our series of New Horizons events that we're doing in association with our Without Borders podcast. I'm Brendan Craig. I'm the founder and managing partner of Taito. And for those of you that haven't joined any of the events that we've been holding, a little bit of background. You know, as we kind of went into lockdown situations around the world, we just thought that as we are kind of all working remotely, separated from the outside world, that it kind of seemed more important than ever that we should bring people together, sort of exchange ideas, knowledge, and kind of talk about how we're managing the present and also sort of planning for the future. And I'm joined by my colleague, Flick Hazelhurst, who's going to be joining our chat with Andy.
Hello, hi everyone. Thanks for joining us live today. Just a quick flag that all of the episodes that we record in this series are also released as podcasts as part of our Without Borders podcast series. So if you want to listen to any of our previous episodes at a later date or recommend this one to any of your colleagues or friends, you can find the Without Borders podcast at taitopr.com or by searching Without Borders on any of your favourite podcast platforms.
Great. So today's discussion is going to be about, is this the end of money as we know it? Who doesn't like talking about money? I know I do. That's probably a bad sign. But anyway, you know, obviously, you know, with the COVID-19 crisis, there's been a tremendous impact on the global economy, on the, you know, different national economies, and it's had a tremendous impact on businesses and individuals as well. And so the purpose of this conversation is really to explore some of those challenges that have kind of occurred, but also to try and sort of raise some question marks about what this holds for the future and whether there are kind of any positive opportunities that might emerge from this. Now, I'm delighted to say that in order to discuss this very exciting topic, that we are joined by Andy Bryan. Andy is the COO of Bitflyer Europe, which is the European arm of Bitflyer. And Andy has an incredible amount of experience, you know, and insight both on sort of global economic and finance issues. So fantastic to have you here, Andy, with your Bitcoin-esque background.
Pleasure to be here. I'm delighted. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me.
So thank you, Andy. So I'm sure that we're going to have, you know, we've got a bunch of questions we're going to be going through with Andy. But for anyone who is joining us on the for the event today, if you look down at the bottom of your Zoom panel, you'll see the option to a tab for Q&A. So please, you know, if you have questions, drop them in there. Flick and I will be looking at those as we go through the event. We'll be taking those, you know, through the course of the discussion. So please, you know, as we go through, do feel free to throw your questions in there. And we're going to sort of kick off, Andy, trying to get like a bit of a sense of perspective on what's going on in the world today. And just kind of understand from your perspective, seen lots of, you know, headlines that are very dramatic headlines. To what extent is what's going on today sort of unprecedented in terms of like historical financial challenges we've had in the past?
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, I'd like to start with like a brief anecdote. So in a previous life, I was an investment banker living and working in Tokyo and working in sort of mergers and acquisitions. And I remember this was back maybe, gosh, like 7 years ago now. I was traipsing around visiting various different companies, and it was shortly after the sort of the last financial crisis of 2008-2009. And I remember to see the so-called Lehman shock, which is what they mostly called it. They didn't call it the global financial crisis. It wasn't really global. They called it the Lehman shock. And it became like a sort of crux, like a blame for sort of all the ills of business. I remember we'd be looking at investor decks and seeing kind of the graph and the financials were going downhill, and everyone said, oh, it was the Lehman shock and it caused this business disruption. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of this situation because everyone looks at COVID-19 and coronavirus and they kind of talk about it as like bringing this unprecedented financial crisis. But to me, COVID-19 was just the pin. It's not COVID's like fault that we're in a situation. I mean, this was kind of building for a long time, and like it could have been several different ways of sort of bursting this bubble. So you know, I think that people like look at this event as kind of somehow special, but actually what's more unprecedented and what's kind of different this time is that the build-up was different. you know, the trigger was different, but then also the effectiveness of the stimulus to follow is also different. So what I mean by that is, like, in terms of the build-up, before 2008, 2009, it was all about sort of build-up of risky subprime debt. Whereas, you know, since then, like, nothing was really changed. And actually, like, this time, debt is everywhere. It's in every bubble. It's not just a subprime bubble. So rather than being confined to Wall Street, this is now more like all assets. In fact, like, the student loan debt, for instance, in the US, that's just one thing, student loans. That's already bigger than the whole subprime outstanding amount. And then add to the mix, like, auto loans, credit card debt, you know, unfunded public pension schemes, like so many different things now that have been sort of built up over time. So the build-up was very much different this time around. The trigger, rather than being a banking crisis as it was in 2008, is the sort of coronavirus and the lockdown. That's different because it's basically a supply shock, a demand shock, and an oil shock, like, all at the same time. By supply shock, I mean that, you know, many factories and production are shut down. By demand shock, I mean people can't, like, leave their homes to go and sort of spend money in shops and retail or go to restaurants. And then oil shock, you know, the oil price has recently gone sort of negative. It's kind of completely unprecedented. So those two things, I think, characterize this crisis as different to the last time. And then finally, last time we actually had some room for maneuver in terms of monetary policy. We had some interest rates that we could drop. This time around, there really isn't much space left to drop interest rates, right? So the government is instead having to rely on, like, huge injection of capital, which they've already been doing via quantitative easing for years. They were just sort of kicking the can down the road. And now I feel like governments around the world are sort of backed into a corner. And the only option they really have is, like, a large scale money printing.
It's interesting that point you make about debt, because that doesn't seem to be getting a huge amount of press coverage, you know, like, as being like that, like a real big issue that's there at the moment. It's kind of, I don't know, I'm guessing it's been sort of slightly camouflaged by everything else that's going on.
Yeah, I guess you don't really hear about it so much, but it's certainly what's happening. I mean, it's been building up, and you can't really blame, like, it's like rational behavior, right? So the interest rates have been very low for a very long time now, and you've had companies all around the world, you know, like, borrowing money at these extremely low rates and using them not to invest in productive purposes, like, you know, R&D or capital expenditure. They've just been using it to sort of buy back their own shares and increase the earnings per share and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of debt in the system, and it's sort of time to reconcile that.
Just kind of like thinking about the next few months, what kind of tangible things do you think that we can expect to see happen?
Well, I think, like, even after the lockdown eventually ends, I don't think things are going to go back to normal straight away, if at all. So, you know, it's not like, you know, in some cases they say, oh, well, there's pent-up demand, right? But it's not like, it's fine, people may delay buying the next iPhone until they can, like, things are back to normal. But it's not like if I missed going out for a steak dinner last week that I'm going to go out for two steak dinners. There's been, like, a whole amount of consumption which has just been sort of wiped away. Meanwhile, it may reopen, but it may reopen with sort of forced underutilization. So, like, planes may be flying with kind of missing, like, enforced gaps in between seats. And even if it's not imposed on companies, we may see consumer behavior will probably have changed. Like, people have been a bit rattled by this. Change spending habits, whether it's, like, sort of wariness or sort of maybe high propensity to save, or even just fear of another sort of resurgence in the virus later on this year. So that's one thing. I don't think it's necessarily going to open up straight away. It's going to be slow. I think this sort of unprecedented stimulus will need to continue. I think there's pretty much no choice. Governments are now buying more and more kind of risky assets to try and prop up the economy. The US Federal Reserve, for instance, has gone beyond sort of buying bonds, bonds and going right up the risk curve, starting to buy junk debt and all sorts of other things. And, you know, in Japan, they've been buying stock ETFs for years. I think they're going to follow. So we're going to see more direct monetization of these types of assets. There's already been like $6 trillion of stimulus, but that hasn't even offset the loss of GDP so far. Mm. So it's not even really stimulus. And they can't put the rates up because, you know, no one can afford to pay like higher interest payments. So the only choice they have is more direct injection of liquidity. And I think, you know, that's not going to stop.
Yeah.
So finally, like, I think what we've, the kind of the way I see it is we've been through this, the liquidity phase. So after this kind of kicked off, like loads of assets like dropped in value, everything sold off, like stocks sold off, bonds sold off, even gold sold off, cryptocurrencies. So that was more connected to the fact that in times of stress, everyone just races for cash. It's like a big cash grab. But we kind of got past that now, and some assets are already recovering. But I think what's kind of coming up next few months is potentially sort of the insolvency phase. So companies around the world who find that they, you know, they've lost this revenue. Many businesses operate on wafer thin margins. So you can't just, you know, have like half of your table empty. You can't afford to run the place like that.
No.
So I think plenty of businesses will sadly kind of go insolvent. And, you know, it's fine if you're in the privileged position of being able to print money for your own sort of companies and citizens, like in the US or other reserve countries like UK, Japan, Eurozone. But like, there are so many countries and companies around the world that have US dollar denominated debts who are outside of this system, kind of offshore dollar markets. And those guys, you know, they typically borrow money denominated in dollars,
Yeah. Stick
to their own local currencies, and then use their local currencies to do stuff, which basically means that eventually they'll need to repay their debt in dollars. And so all of these companies are basically by default short on the dollar. Mm. And when they finally need to get the dollars back to pay off the debts, there's going to be a huge drive for dollars. There's going to be a big spike in demand for dollars. And I think that's potentially the next phase we're going to see is like the dollar rating higher. And the US government obviously doesn't want that because it hurts their exports. So they're going to have to intervene in big ways to do that.
Just picking up on something you said there, Andy, around just picking up on something you said around governments effectively printing money to help people out in this situation. How do you think that that's going to affect people's perception of the value of money in the longer term?
Well, yeah, this is it. I mean, I think people like are finally starting. I actually think this is quite, in some ways, a good thing because people are finally starting to question, like, what actually is money. Right? So it's fine. Like when it's like day to day things, and you kind of people don't really think about it because £10 today is going to basically be worth the same as £10 tomorrow. Right. So people, they get their paycheck, they buy things, and they kind of forget about it. But now we're seeing like trillions and trillions and trillions of new money just being created. Nothing. And people are starting to take a step back and think, well, hang on, like, what, you know, what is this money thing? Like, it can be just created like that so easily. Like, why are we working our backsides off to pay income tax? Like, why are there homeless people when we can just invent $6 trillion people out of nowhere? $6 trillion out of nowhere. Like, what was the point in all that austerity of the last 10 years? Like, why does it feel like
it makes kind of like educating your children on the value of money a bit more challenging, doesn't it?
Well, exactly. Like people are starting to think, well, you know, I feel like everything's the same, but I feel like everything's getting more expensive. Like, is my money actually like a good storehold of wealth? Storehold of wealth is like a fundamental property of money.
Are there if you look at kind of different assets, I'm guessing, and to your point about as a store of value in relation to like the kind of like regular assets that we probably all think of, like, well, some of us might think of in terms of cars, houses, etc. Have those assets kind of, are they more expensive today with the money that we've got than say, you know, 20 years ago?
Well, it's really interesting you should mention cars, right? Because I think cars are the one area of the sort of normal mainstream economy where people do actually understand store of value. Because everyone understands that you buy a new car and it loses value. Okay. Mm. So like imagine if we shrinked all cars down to tiny size and we were using cars as currency, like, people wouldn't really want to hold on to them because they'd be like, well, I'm going to lose purchasing power over time. But nobody thinks about that, like, things like that about money, whereas it's exactly the same for money. Money also loses its purchasing power over time. It's just it's less easy to notice because you've got plenty of it coming in and plenty of it going out. So it's really good that people are gonna like start to think about this, but what it may do is start to cause like an undermine confidence in fiat currency as a reliable store of value.
Yeah.
That's what I think is gonna be one of the main sort of changes in mindset after this crisis. When people see so much money being created from nothing, they're gonna start to lose.
And what just, I think obviously what you and I do in the world is probably fairly insignificant. Maybe you with your like massive store of like Bitcoins, you know, you can maybe have an influence on the global economy, but myself, you know, most people can't. But how do you think we should, how do you think sort of, I don't know, individuals and business owners and things should be preparing for this next period?
So you mean like what advice can I give for businesses? Well,
I mean, maybe there isn't anything much people can do, but...
Oh, there's plenty you can do. I mean, I think the main thing is like, first of all, for individuals, like don't panic, because we've gone through this cycle like so many times already. It just so happens that the main kind of like, there's sort of three trends that are all mixed together. There's like gradual productivity increase over time. There's like short-term credit booms and busts, which kind of happen every sort of 20, 30 years. And then there's like the long-term credit cycle, which is basically sort of 75 years between each time. And that, the latter is just long enough. So the last time it happened, like we were basically too young to care or like weren't alive by then. So we keep finding ourselves in a situation where like, you know, we're repeating the same cycle that's happened. And there are methods to handle it and to cope with it. But you know, I think for advice, I would say don't read too much news. Like the media have figured out that COVID is like the ultimate clickbait. Spend time outside, focus on mental health. But from an investing perspective, which are probably what you're asking me, I think for me, first of all, I should just disclaim that, you know, I'm just one person and I'm not, you know, you shouldn't take my investment advice as gospel. But for me, a lot of people, they end up just kind of holding cash, like because most people aren't that sophisticated and they just save and, you know, they leave investing to professionals and so on. They think that cash is like neutral, but cash isn't really neutral. Like it's like when you have a vote and you think we can vote for or against, or you can abstain. People assume that like abstaining is neutral, but it's not. Abstaining is like still very much an intentional act. Just like holding cash from an investing perspective is like taking a position. So like people that stay in cash, they maybe fail to sort of appreciate that it is a loss-making asset over time. And they don't diversify. And so, you know, you should keep, you've got these pounds in the bank and the pounds going down against other currencies. And, you know, I would suggest that you do try and diversify a little bit. Maybe leave off the stock market for the time being. And if you want to just hold cash, then at least buy some dollars, buy some euros and spread your money around. But then, of course, like if it was me and sort of my portfolio, you know, gold is in there, Bitcoin, of course, and I don't try and time the market. So like by now, the stock market's completely arbitrary. Like I saw an image the other day of like the background said, you know, Dow has greatest day since 1987. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom, it said like millions of US citizens lose their jobs. The stock markets have been completely decoupled from reality. And that's partly to do with what's been happening with all this financial. Mm-hmm. We've got oil going into negative territory. We've got like flash crashes all over the place. So it's very, very sort of scary out there in terms of trying to time the markets. So if you do want to invest in the markets, spread your investments and like invest small amounts regularly over time.
And do you think we've already seen the way that people invest change since this crisis has hit, and particularly in kind of your area of cryptocurrencies? Do you think that that people have changed their behavior in terms of wanting to invest there?
Well, it's funny that I saw that the other exchanges like BitFlyer have been reporting, especially in the US, like the precise number of people, or at least the number of customers who recently deposited precisely $1,200 into their trading account to buy Bitcoin, which just happens to be the exact same amount as the stimulus check that loads of people have been getting in the US. So yeah, I think like more and more people are starting to sort of look at Bitcoin as an alternative to this like financial system, which seems to be kind of on its knees right now. And the cryptocurrency, as well as other assets, like maybe a smart investment. So yeah, we have noticed that. We'd expect that to continue.
What do you think, just thinking about that, just kind of extending that a bit further, what do you think the longer term outlook is for digital currencies, and will the kind of events that are going on at the moment be kind of, you know, like, will they kind of be a boost for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Bloomberg just actually wrote a piece about how, you know, 2020 will be the year that Bitcoin kind of cements its reputation as a digital gold. I think, you know, Bitcoin was built for this purpose, right? Even in the first sort of Bitcoin block on the blockchain, there was a sort of hidden message that referenced a Times article from 2009 saying, like, the headline was "Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks." Right? So there was like a political message in there, which is like, this is an alternative to you know, this sort of financial system, which is prone to booms and busts, kind of the fallacies of fiat currency and sort of, you know, infinite supply, basically. So it's just like a digital alternative to that. And yeah, I think it's going to really change people's mindsets over the next months and years. It's still progress to be made. It's still a bit difficult to use. It's, you know, that people read the news of hacks and so on and funds being lost from exchanges. But I think as the usability improves and, you know, more and more institutions move into the space, I even predict that it won't be too long before the first sovereign wealth funds allocates a certain amount to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So I really see that trend advancing.
Someone's actually asked whether they think whether you think the Chinese central bank will be the first to offer a central bank digital currency.
Yes, absolutely. And that was even one of my kind of predictions for 2020, which I wrote back in January. Yeah, so so-called central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, is like kind of quite interesting. So this is where the government decides they want to basically pioneer and launch their own blockchain or DLT-based cryptocurrency with like all of the benefits in terms of efficiency and speed and instant settlement, 24/7 markets, automated compliance, all of that, but while still keeping the control and without having sort of public, you know, permissionless, borderless nature. So that they're trying to harness blockchain for their own means. Now, there are benefits to that. For instance, if we had CBDCs now, then this kind of stimulus payments could be made like far more easily, especially in the US. People could like automatically like redeem new dollars in their account without having to kind of apply or wait or do any form of it. And, you know, it could be just much better organized and managed. On the flip side, though, if you're worried about sort of transactional privacy, then, you know, that'll be the end of privacy. Once you're transacting directly with the central bank, then of course they can see every single financial movement you do. So some people worry about the, you know, this more sensitive nature of that financial privacy as well. So it swings and roundabouts.
Yeah.
How I think it's not the first though. Sorry, just to answer that question finally. Yeah, I think many banks all around the world are looking at CBDCs, whether it's UK, Canada, US, Germany, New Zealand. But China, I feel, are the furthest ahead, and they're even starting to sort of test their own CBDC now. I think they'll be the first to launch, actually.
Right.
How far behind do you think the likes of the US and the UK and Europe are, out of interest?
Not too far behind. I think, that, I mean, they're definitely, whether through want or through necessity, like all the big institutions are now looking at it. The Bank of England has done some pretty good reports and studies, and I think many banks are piloting it. But then in terms of actually launching it, who's going to launch first? You know, I feel like some of those Western democracies may take a bit longer, and in Europe, I don't see any sort of Euro CBDC coming anytime soon, just because it's so much more complicated to coordinate those sorts of things with different stakeholders. I should mention as well, though, that the Chinese one is going to start off kind of slightly limited, in that it's only going to be sort of M0 currency, or sort of, it's not going to include bank deposits. It's going to be more like sort of cash, and it's going to be sort of not for international payments. It's going to start off with domestic payments at the start, and then later on they'll sort of open it up to cross-border transactions.
Cool. And just thinking slightly more widely than just cryptocurrencies, can you talk a little bit about the concept of decentralized finance and how the current situation could help to push such a concept forward?
Mm-hmm. So decentralized finance, I think, is incredibly interesting. And for me, it was like one of the natural sort of evolutions of blockchain technology. What is decentralized finance? Well, decentralized finance is basically a brand new financial and economic system built from the ground up on blockchain technology. So it uses all of the sort of benefits of blockchain, being kind of borderless, permissionless. You can innovate on the fringes, but we kind of rebuilt for replacing the centralized financial system we have now. So if you imagine, like, right now we have all of these different financial institutions, they all have shareholders that like need to make money somehow. We all have, like, my wallet's got like 8 different cards in it. I had one bank that I chose because they had the best credit card. I had another which had like a decent savings rate once upon a time. I have like one company for my pension and another for trading and so on and so forth. But there's really no interoperability between any of those. So kind of loans, most people get sort of loans and credit and all from the same bank, and maybe they get their mortgage from the same bank because it's just straightforward. It just means that you're kind of trapped in these sort of local ecosystems and stacks. And apart from anything else, like, they're all run by companies that have shareholders that like to somehow make money. And so, you know, you're paying for the costs to run that organization, costs of running retail branches, the costs of hiring people, so on and so forth. So it all comes at a cost. With DeFi, they basically, you can reimagine like all the financial primitives, whether it's loans, interest-bearing assets, trading, investing, capital allocation, but now like on the blockchain. So it's basically powered by technology. Now it's very young still, and there are still many issues that need to be resolved. But it's growing immensely fast, incredibly fast, and it's completely separate from the current financial system, right? So I think, given that that current financial system is showing sort of signs of strain at the moment, I think that may push people towards, like, if they're worried about it, they'll push them towards dipping their toes into DeFi. For instance, right now I can make 8.6% interest on my US dollars just by converting it into a US dollar stable coin and putting it in this DeFi ecosystem. So, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly exciting, because there are so many different properties that it has that the current financial ecosystem doesn't have. Mm. I talked about centralization. One thing about DeFi is the so-called composability. So you can basically have all of these like money Legos that you can fit together and they can do sort of new things, right? So you may have sort of one system that allows you to deposit money and gives you interest. And then you have like another system which can take that interest and sort of filter it or direct it into other investments, and you can sort of plug them together, and then you can wrap that in a sort of automated investment manager, and that can plug into something else. So it allows like these new things that you can do that you could like literally never do in today's system. Apart from anything else, you've got a global community of like very smart people who are all working this stuff at the same time. You don't have to kind of go and get a job at a bank and then work on something proprietary that may never see the light of day. You've got this like whole world of like new experiments. Mm. You've got like a guy in Russia sitting in his pajamas writing like at 4 a.m. writing a piece of code, which 2 months later is being used to transact like hundreds of millions of dollars of cryptocurrency. And all of this innovation kind of compounds over time. So it's moving like faster and faster every day. It's even beat my expectations for how quickly it's been moving since the beginning of this year and last year. So I'm really excited about DeFi. I think it's going to really change the way that the financial system works, and I think that this crisis is going to accelerate that trend.
And just on that note, where is the most innovation coming from in the world?
In the DeFi space?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of it's in the US, I guess. But to be honest, it's hard to say because it's so
distributed.
This type of thing is like it kind of breaks our notion of kind of how companies and like enterprise really works, because with this sort of blockchain paradigm, we're reimagining the way that companies and enterprise happens altogether. For starters, I think it's going to create a whole new generation of startups that are going to be very different from the startups we know today. First of all, they're going to be sort of funded by issuing assets on the blockchain. So kind of like what the ICOs were, but a more mature version. They're going to be new companies that are funded by some kind of tokenized assets, number one, to the VC. Number two, they'll be able to like issue these tokens to their users to actually incentivize the bootstrapping growth at the beginning. A bit like, you know, if you were one of the first 100 users to use Skype, you got no reward for that except for maybe bragging rights. But now with these new generation of companies, we can issue these kind of tokens that can actually incentivize the early users to actually evangelize the platform and really right. in a new incentive way. And then thirdly, these companies are going to be kind of globally native. Instead of today where you may set up a company in the UK and then you sort of you get the license to run in that company and then you pull those efforts to that company and then eventually you'll sort of expand into the next country, like get the license for that country, like build the payment methods for that country and so on and so forth. We've now got this new global paradigm where from day one these crypto and blockchain companies are kind of completely borderless, apolitical. Like they can be run remotely by a team that's spread all over the world. So it's going to change our sort of startup mindset to a very much globally native mindset, I think.
And I think this, you might have, I think you've sort of slightly covered this question, but I think one of the things that that I think has been kind of well documented is that when you have recessions, that as much as there's destruction, that often they end up being sort of very fertile ground for innovation as people like adapt to new times.
Oh, absolutely.
I know, you know, there's like Uber, Airbnb, Microsoft, Google, all of them kind of like took off or emerged at times of where they were off the back of recessions. What sort of businesses or what sort of innovation do you think we might see it off the back of COVID-19?
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree. Like, actually, recessions are often where some really interesting entrepreneurship kind of is born. And I think there's plenty of reasons for that. Firstly, like, shakeouts like this remind us of the necessity of productive enterprise. Rather than sort of pushing money around and kind of like pieces of paper flying backwards and forwards and sort of trying to create economic value that way, we're kind of reminded that actually, unless you make new stuff, unless you develop new goods and services, that's the only really way to grow wealth. Like, yes. And we feel like we're getting richer by coming up with all these new financial instruments, but we're just sort of pushing the same money around. So, you know, shakeouts remind us of this sort of productive enterprise and the necessity of it. Often people get laid off and finally decide to do that company that they'd always wanted to do, they'd always imagined but been too scared to do, and then suddenly they have the necessity to do so or the impetus.
Yeah.
And so that's why you get a lot of startups also kind of born out of recession. But then I think, you know, I've kind of covered what I think is going to happen in terms of the changing nature of technology startups overall. I think fintech and especially blockchain and crypto, which is close to my heart, is going to see extremely high growth. But of course, what's also happening is our habits are starting to change. We're starting to realize, hey, actually, I didn't have to have an in-person meeting for that. A phone call would have done just fine. Having changing habits with people sort of more willingly transacting, doing business and ordering stuff online. You know, people are starting to socialize and online. And so there's all sorts of things that I think will change after that. And new businesses or like old businesses may start to find that they never really recover the demand they used to have. You know, there's people sitting at home who've never cut their own hair before, like buying hair clippers, finding out that actually it's fine, so they may never go to the hairdresser again.
So, you know, are you one of those people, Andy?
No, actually, like, I've got my quarantine beard here, so enjoying the delights of discovering drink milk with a moustache. But yeah, I think, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention, and we're going to see a lot of changing trends coming out of it. And then also other things like we're going to kind of start various things we're going to question, like supply chains. We're going to really, when we come out the other side of this, we're going to be questioning the globalization of supply chains in terms of like, why didn't we have the stuff we needed? Why didn't we have the medical supplies and the PPE? Why didn't we have the ventilators? Why was it all being manufactured elsewhere? Surely that's like quite a strategic thing to be able to make in your own country. Like, we have different states in the US bidding against each other to buy ventilators. Like, that's the same country. So there's all of these like questions about, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't have just offshored everything to China or offshored everything to these other low-cost countries. Maybe we should start to rethink about supply chains. Or maybe we break down supply chains into kind of more fragmented but sort of diverse and lean systems. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there as well fundamentally rethinking kind of just in time.
Yeah. What do you think? So probably this is probably quite a big question to open up towards the end of this conversation, but there's obviously a lot of stuff that's going on today, which you would kind of associate with kind of more of a, like a planned economy, kind of state led economy type, you know, situation. But actually a lot of this has been done by governments that you would associate with kind of more like free market ideas. You know, is the free market doomed?
I think, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's funny to see the kind of policies that are being enacted now, like rapidly, are the kind of the same ones where these more left-wing political candidates are being chastised in the press for like, oh, they're going to bankrupt our economy, they're going to print all this money, and that's exactly what the more conservative governments are doing. So I think that's quite ironic. I think in terms of free market, I think we haven't really had a real free market for quite a while now. It's not a free market where you've got, you know, supply and demand are sort of fundamentally mismatched. It's not a free market where the risk and return equation has been completely broken, where you have like airlines that spent 90% of their net profits over the last 10 years buying back their own shares and then just getting bailed out by the government for, you know, when things get tough. It's not a free market where like, all of these types of things are happening. So it's kind of like a, you know, we've got stock, when there's bad news, the stock prices go up, and when there's like, unless it's really bad, in which case it might come down, but then people expect stimulus, so it goes up again. Like the sort of value investing and the notion of sort of looking at fundamentals of companies has like completely decoupled from the stock market and other markets. So it's all about psychology now and stimulus and like, what's the government going to do next? And what has Donald Trump said yesterday? And, you know, we wouldn't see oil falling 200% to like minus $40 if we weren't in a completely sort of strange like system. So,
yeah. And so maybe kind of just closing off, what's your kind of biggest prediction as far as the global future of the global financial system is concerned over the next 5 to 10 years?
Whew, 5 to 10 years is quite a long time.
Yeah.
I can like,
or maybe you've got one or two bets that you would make, you know, in terms of things that will happen.
I've got a few sort of short, quick fire predictions, and then maybe one that's probably a bit more controversial.
Yeah.
First, I think cryptocurrencies will be in everyone's portfolio in 5-10 years time. I just think the asymmetry of that investment is just too attractive to ignore. And when you have something which, you know, might lose 50 or 100% of its value, but might go up by 20x, 50x. You know, you might as well have 1% of your portfolio, you know, in this type of asset. I think more and more people are going to realize that. So I think cryptocurrencies will be in everyone's portfolio. I think Bitcoin allocation in sovereign wealth funds will happen for the first time. I think CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies, will take hold very much so in the next 5 to 10 years. I think based on the speed of DeFi or decentralized finance developments, I think automation of the economic machinery will render it unrecognizable what we have today. And I think human minds will become increasingly passengers of this new system. It's going to be a lot of automation, a lot of algorithmic decision making in economic terms. But I think the big one will be that we'll have a new global monetary system. It will reset, just like it has reset every 50 years for hundreds of years. And I think US dollar as like the only reserve currency, the main reserve currency, I think that will be changed. And I see a world of multilateral reserve currencies and the kind of the end of US dollar dominance. That's my big prediction, I'd say.
That's a big one. That's definitely a big one to finish on. Thanks so much, Andy, for joining us. It's been really, really exciting and interesting hearing your perspectives on things. I think my takeaways are that we should keep calm, because although this situation seems unprecedented, we've kind of been here before. You know, probably if you haven't already, we should be looking to get cryptocurrencies into our portfolios. And actually, you know, these kind of times are, as you say, you know, that expression, you know, what is that expression? That necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that we can expect, you know, lots more innovation in fintech and in other sectors as off the back of this. So Thanks so much for joining us. If anyone wants to learn more about Andy, you can check out his website, which is andybryant.me. Or if for those who are crypto curious or want to learn more about BitFlyer, you can go to bitflyer.com. Thank you also for our guests joining us and sharing your questions and thoughts. And then our next event is going to be next Friday at the same time, and it's going to be with Morten Brogge, who's the CEO of Wire, and we're going to be talking about reimagining the future of work in an uncertain world, which is going to be another great discussion. What we'll do is we'll be releasing this as a podcast. So for any of you that want to share this with contacts and friends, then we'll be sharing the details as well. So thank you so much, Andy. Really great to catch up with you and
about
this.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Have a great afternoon.
Stay safe.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.